And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from the National Constitution Center, we have Elena Popchak. She is exhibition developer and has just opened the latest exhibit, and it's the Women's Suffrage Movement and 19th Amendment exhibit. And welcome back.
Thanks so much, Laura. It's great to be here.
You know, the last time you were in here, you had just opened the Reconstruction piece, and that is a permanent exhibit at the National Constitution Center. And when you go to the women's exhibit, it's that they fit together so well. Was that always part of the intention when doing this?
Well, even when we were working on the Civil War and Reconstruction exhibit, we knew that the centennial anniversary of the 19th Amendment was approaching in 2020. So we knew that these galleries would work so well together, and the topics and themes introduced in the Civil War and Reconstruction exhibit would be a great primer to then understand the women's suffrage movement, because you have origins of the women's movement in abolitionist causes, and you see how women start organizing in that early period and continue their fight after the Reconstruction amendments ultimately exclude them from the ballot box and only open up voting to African American men. So we knew that that story needed to continue. So I'm glad to hear that after seeing it, that it, those do speak really well together, because that was certainly our hope.
So let's get to the start, 1848 and the Seneca Falls Convention. Can you talk to us about what was a woman's life before that? I know that Abigail Adams notoriously wrote to her husband and saying, don't forget the women in what you are working upon. And of course they did.
Well, something I love about that quote is the second part of it that often gets cut off is she says, remember that all men would be tyrants if they could. So it's a lovely part as far as why you need to remember the ladies. So when we get to 1848, it became clear to me when I was doing research that it's hard to collapse all diverse women and their diverse experiences at this time. So while remembering there are women of color who are having very different experiences, either in enslavement or living free amongst a society that embraced slavery. So there's that story. There's an element of married women who in particular are having rights taken away from them as soon as they enter marriage. So when I say, you know, they don't have rights to their own children, any of their personal belongings, they can't own property. These are all rights that they're fighting for. And then you have unmarried women or widows that have a limited set of rights at this time. So, you know, it's challenging to collapse that all into something, but we choose to focus on how married women in particular were fighting for those rights at the beginning period. And then in 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton in particular champions that they should fight for the right to vote. And ultimately, it isn't until 1865 with the end of the Civil War that they choose to focus solely on getting the right to vote, enabling them to then secure all these other reforms.
So who were the characters leading into 1848? There had to be leaders out there to gather. And where were they coming from? Who were they?
So most of them were primarily coming from the abolitionist movement. So you see a lot of women who are participating in anti-slavery societies. They're organizing their own female anti-slavery societies. And in particular, a lot of Quakers. So we do see a lot around Philadelphia, in particular, a lot of activity, including Lucretia Mott at this time. And they're starting to get together under that umbrella of anti-slavery societies and starting to discuss, well, if there's these broader equality that we're talking about, let's talk about ourselves. So as they start to create these groups, their conversations lead to pushing for these other types of reforms for themselves. So women like Lucretia Mott, of course, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, these are the two that primarily organize the Seneca Falls Convention in New York. But there's important allies in people like Frederick Douglass or William Lloyd Garrison at this early point. And we do see some women of color that are in the historical record noted as being part of conventions that continue into the 1850s, such as Sojourner Truth, who did speak at these conventions, but there's an untold number of women of mostly free women of color or formerly enslaved who were able to participate in these conventions, but we don't necessarily have a record of those women.
A dumb question here. Was this mostly a Northern movement? Was there Southern participation in the women's efforts? It's 1848. That's still antebellum.
It's a great question. And it's tied to that anti-slavery push. So because the South primarily by this point is the part of the country that's still practicing slavery, they're very much opposed to women's rights organizing. So it does start as a primarily white, privileged, educated movement in the Northeast. And then it doesn't really occur until the 1890s when you see some of Southern states having organizing at that level, and some Southern women start to join the cause. But because it was just so tied to anti-slavery, it took them a lot longer to organize in the South.
What did they think after emancipation? What did they see they had accomplished?
Well, it's an important moment in 1865 as the war ends, women start to pursue suffrage. And they start to merge their cause to push for universal suffrage, so including African-American men in their fight. And all of these interests are together. Let's fight for freedom and equality for all, for voting rights for all. And unfortunately, what we get is the 14th and 15th Amendments. The 14th Amendment inserts the word male in the Constitution for the first time. That's a significant moment. And the 15th Amendment excludes women. And there's activists such as Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton who are appalled at the fact that white educated women have been excluded from this moment of change and that Black men are getting the right to vote before them. So where their causes are so linked early on, you then see this pivot to these racist ideas seeping in to the movement and affecting what they're pushing for. So there's a huge group of the women's suffrage movement that breaks away. And it isn't until the 1890s that they come back together with their causes, but the racism continues for the rest of the movement.
Well, is this where we have a discussion about what is happening to the votes Black men had achieved? Because here we're already seeing their rights whittled away and through things like poll taxes and through written tests, et cetera. As their rights are now declining, is that what brings them back together again?
So definitely great to know, because by the 1890s, you're seeing extreme discriminatory practices being introduced in the South and entering more of that Jim Crow era that we're familiar with, when huge parts of the population are kept from the vote. And by this point in the 1890s, the women's suffrage movement is primarily a women's cause with fewer men participating in it versus the earlier movement. There was a lot of support and a lot of the leaders were actually men. But by the time we get to the late 1800s, there's, with that disenfranchisement happening in the South, but also across the country, I haven't seen them linked in that way, that why the movement would come back together at that point. But it's interesting to note that those are happening at the same time.
Why do the men drop out of the fight?
There's still certainly support among men. I think it comes down to who were the leaders. So that early period where it was that kind of blurred line between what was the movement of the anti-slavery forces and then the leaders of this women's rights organizing, there's a definite shared leadership between. And I think because 1848 is still a time when women are supposed to stay at home, and it's controversial for them to leave the home and go speak in public. Like, that's one of the rights they're fighting for. So it was more acceptable to have that male leadership. And by the time you get to the late 1800s, it's much more acceptable. And you just see that women are specifically taking those leadership roles. So I see it as progress, not as men dropping out from support of those ranks.
If you're just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and today we are talking to Elena Popchak. She is the exhibition developer for the 19th Amendment, How Women Won the Vote, which is on display now at the National Constitution Center, along with the amazing Civil War and Reconstruction exhibit. If you want more information about the programming, how to get to see it, background information, hours, go to constitutioncenter.org. That's constitutioncenter.org. You see ballot boxes, you see the photographs. How did you assemble, and what are some of the pieces that we really need to look for? What are some of those key exhibit pieces that are the no miss, or the ones that you go, oh my gosh, I got my paws on that?
So every time I start working on an exhibit, I begin with the artifacts, because I want to see what is out there, what exists, what was saved, and then that helps to build the backbone of how the stories are told. So if you've ever seen the Civil War and Reconstruction exhibit, or now the 19th Amendment exhibit, I love artifacts. They're such tangible connections to the past. So anytime I'm able to make that available to our visitors and bring that all into one space, I just find that very powerful. So one of the first artifacts that I came across that is a can't miss, and I'm so excited we got it in the actual exhibit, was a ballot box from the Reconstruction era, because it has women's ballots stamped on it. And it's an interesting period where we think, well, that's decades before the 19th Amendment is ratified. Why would there be a ballot box for women's ballots? So I love that it sparks that curiosity, and it did in me as well. Well, upon doing further research, I learned how there were, beginning in 1869, some states or territories granting women either full voting rights or voting rights in certain types of elections. So this ballot box would have been a separate box for women living in one of those states to be able to vote in a particular election. Let's say it's a school board election or a municipal election. And that would ensure that they weren't voting for higher level offices. So you do see them around. They exist. And they're from that early period. So we do have it in the show. I'm just so grateful we were able to secure it for the exhibit. And one of my absolute favorites of a whole section that we took over an entire wall of all the really cool women's suffrage memorabilia that you see produced during this time. And not only is it just visually compelling to look at, all the colors, symbols are just so powerful. By having this wall taken over, you get a sense of that variety, and you get a feel for some of the slogans that they were using to get the word out that they wanted the vote and why they should get the vote. So it speaks volumes, and we tried to show that through the volume of items produced. So I love how that turned out. And we also have a letter later in the exhibit written by a Philadelphia native. Her name is Dora Lewis, and she was a suffragist who traveled to Washington, D.C. as part of the National Woman's Party, and she was one of the first women who picketed the White House. So 1917, that's picketing the White House, was the first the nation had ever seen, and she is ultimately, along with many other women, arrested and thrown in a workhouse prison outside Washington, D.C. And she actually wrote that letter from prison. And it's from a local collection, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. So anytime I can bring back that national story to a local focus, I love to do that. And lastly, we wouldn't be a 19th Amendment exhibit without a 19th Amendment copy. So So we have Pennsylvania's own ratification copy featured prominently at the end of the exhibit.
You also have, though, materials from the other side, the side saying do not allow women to vote.
So let's not forget, with any change, there are always two sides. And there's a reason why it took 70 years to get to the 19th Amendment, because there were plenty of people who were opposed to that. And we feature a paper fan from the Massachusetts anti-suffrage organization that lists all the reasons why women should not vote. We have anti-suffrage buttons, and they're interestingly all the color red, because that was the color they adopted as a, you know, as a color that represents stop or no, certainly fits. But we introduce you at that spot in the exhibit to the anti-suffragists, because their arguments against are very telling of the time. And, you know, going from people pushing for states' rights and against a national amendment that would push for voting laws, they're also, you know, saying ridiculous things, that families are going to fall apart if women are allowed to go vote twice a year. So it's hard to wrap your head around that moment in time, but that gives you a window into it.
What actually happens with the 19th Amendment's passage when it's ratified?
So the text of the amendment exclusively bans voter discrimination on the basis of sex. It mirrors the language of the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed voting rights for Black men. And there are some problems with that, because it focuses on one type of discrimination. So when we get to 1920, there's other types of discrimination that are allowed to continue. And as we mentioned earlier, with Black men being denied the right to vote beginning in the late 1800s, those practices, including poll taxes and literacy tests, are already in place. And women of color by 1920, they know that they're not going to be included in this moment of change, because they're subjected to those firmly entrenched practices, and they're turned away and prevented from going to the ballot box. So where we think of it being the end point, it is a continuation for some women. And you also see women who know that the vote enables them to have more of a voice and push for change. And some are pursuing special workplace protections for women or focusing on infant health. And of course, we end up with 1923, the Equal Rights Amendment is proposed for the first time in Congress. So only 3 years after the 19th Amendment, Alice Paul, a New Jersey native, starts pursuing the ERA, and certainly something that brings us to the present, because Virginia ratified this year, 2020, although it's not on the top of mind right now for most people. It's still a live issue that, you know, figuring out something that was proposed nearly 100 years ago, where we go from here.
It was interesting, you have a map that shows the states that have ratified the ERA and then the states that have rescinded their ratification. And is that
it
legal?
It certainly puts a wrinkle into understanding where it is right now, because it's not a simple, you know, it would be ratified, but we're not sure, because we haven't experienced that before with states attempting to rescind, or that a time limit was a deadline was put baked into the amendment when it was proposed, that it needed to be ratified by a certain date, and that date has passed. So there are many questions that would need to be resolved before we're able to figure out where it actually is.
What are, now when you have an exhibit like this, you usually do include study materials. There are lectures, there are town halls around them. What's being planned for this, especially under the circumstances that we're experiencing right now?
So in celebration of the centennial anniversary on August 26th, which is when we opened the exhibit, we presented a series of programs, including live tours of the exhibit, live talks with scholars, theatrical readings, and this is all available on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Constitution Center. So you can actually see me giving mini tours of the exhibit. So what I'm talking about, you can see it in the space. And this is all part of our initiative that we launched at the beginning of this year called Women in the Constitution. It's in celebration of women's equality and leadership. And So in addition to this exhibit, it's a year-long initiative, including constitutional conversations and debates, podcasts, blog posts, educational materials for learners of all ages to enjoy from the comfort of their home. So this is all available on our website, constitutioncenter.org.
Are there teaching materials for this for the classrooms?
There are, and I'm really excited that in conjunction with the exhibit, we developed interactives that we have made available on our website. So some of the content can be accessed and enjoyed at home. But even if you visit in person, you see it, experience it here, you can then take it home with you and delve into it further. So we have developed three different interactives. One is called The Awakening, which shows how some states were passing voting rights for women as early as 1869, and we visualize that on a map and show how it moved from the West to the East leading up to the 19th Amendment. And we have one called The Debates, where I was pulling some of those really funny but also head-scratching arguments for and against women's suffrage that we've compiled into an interactive that has all the topics organized, but also the voices that we recorded by actors and actresses. So you can not only read about these, but hear the debates. And lastly, as part of our interactive constitution, we added a feature for the drafting table, which we had already done for the Reconstruction Amendments, but we traced the evolution of the 19th Amendment's text from when it was first proposed to when it was finally passed in Congress in 1919.
It's interesting, and this is completely off topic, when you mention that equality started in the West, in the new states, in the new territories, where everybody is basically barefoot and digging in the ground. And in the North and on the East Coast, the educated women are not getting those same rights.
It is confusing how you see where change is being pushed for and where change is actually happening. And something that was very eye-opening for me when I was researching is in particular looking at the local area. So looking at Pennsylvania, looking at New York, these are states that never granted women any type of voting rights. When you look at that map and you see literally sweeping from the West to the East, they're these states that are holding out. And so for New York, it actually isn't until 1917, so barely before the amendment gets passed, do they grant full voting rights. But it's the first state in the East that does so. But for all of those years, when you see states, even like Tennessee, passing voting rights for women in some form, you can't even get that in Pennsylvania.
Is 1917, is the war an important part of what happens, the final push?
It's very significant. And what you see in that moment in 1917, when the United States enters the war in Europe, so World War I, that some women are pausing their efforts, their work, they're contributing to the war effort. And that's very courageous and noted amongst politicians, including President Woodrow Wilson. But there's other women who are placing more pressure on politicians because they're seeing us fighting a war for democracy abroad, but raising the red flag that you're leaving half of your home population without the vote. How can that be a true democracy? So it allows, it's an opportunity for women to point that out in ways that were very tangible. And Wilson ultimately is encouraged by women's contributions during the war and their sacrifices and their patriotism to allow them to participate fully in the democracy. So it's a very pivotal moment. It helps us understand why it gets passed in 1919.
We mostly think about World War II with Rosie the Riveter, but in World War I, women were picking up wrenches and going in and working on the war effort.
And not just in what we think of as nurses or just creating vegetable gardens at home. There are photographs in the exhibit that show women working in factories, even ones that were local to the Philadelphia area in the suburbs. So it's important to remember that it isn't just World War II. That goes back decades when women were, you know, working in factories and creating munitions and, you know, serving as radio clerks and translators. Those were all very significant war-focused duties.
And it got them to protest in 1917. 2017 in front of the White House.
It did. And it's those final few years that you see a lot more of the public facing tactics, such as picketing and parading through the streets of Washington, D.C., and you know, those more traditional protest tactics that we're familiar with today. That didn't happen until the final few years of the movement, but certainly helped the public sentiments to change in favor of women's suffrage.
What about Europe? Around the world, were American women excluded for something that other women were enjoying?
So there is a lot of collaboration that you see, particularly between the British suffrage movement that's in full force in the early 1900s, and women, including Alice Paul, are bringing the tactics that they're seeing abroad and bringing them to the American movement. So there's collaboration and, you know, inspiration between. And I came across suffragists who were attending international conventions, and there being a sharing of stories and how to pursue voting rights for women. So there are countries that are getting the vote for women before the United States is, and they're arguing, particularly during World War One, come on, you got to add us to this list if we're really going to compete as a democracy on the world stage. And it's interesting to see how that inspiration comes over from the British suffrage movement, because you also see it in the artifacts that are produced. You have to have a certain eye to figure out whether something is actually British or it's American, because they were borrowing colors and symbols from them. So there was a lot of collaboration.
Wilson, because of the war, and I know that Wilson obviously was more of a global thinker. Was that one of the reasons behind any support that he gave to this? Because he knew that the United States was now, for the first time, a world power broker.
I think it's a compelling argument to Wilson and why he ultimately deems it a war measure. That's one of his speeches, focuses on women's suffrage as a war measure. So it absolutely contributes. Because before that, he would say that he was for women's suffrage in theory, just not with a national amendment, because he believed it should remain with the states to determine voter qualifications. So his pivot to the national amendment, I think absolutely looking at it in the lens of World War One and our place in the world, helps to convince him that women should get the right to vote. And I should also say that there's what you see at the first national suffrage parade in Washington, D.C. So thinking of like an early march on Washington, are the suffragists. And if you look closely at the photographs, and there's also footage from that march, they're holding banners from different delegations, such as Australia, where women do have the vote. So that, particularly by the 19-teens, is a compelling argument where you start to see those countries where women do have the vote and placing a lot of pressure on our politicians. Hey, we should have it as well.
What are the parting thoughts that you want someone to walk away from the exhibit with?
I would love for people to feel empowered by the generations of women who dedicated their lives and sometimes never saw that change happen, but they kept pushing. They kept getting up and pushing for that change. And it comprises three generations of women, sometimes in the same family, that fought for this change, and some did live to see the amendment ratified. But here we are 100 years from now, and let's just think about those sacrifices and those contributions that these women that you may have heard of or you may never have heard of. I've tried to include as many as I can to share their amazing stories and just remember how far we've come. And remember that even after 70 years, there were still women who couldn't vote after 1920. And that's part of the ongoing push for equal access to the ballot box. So I just hope that there's a sense of hope and empowerment as people leave this exhibit.
And of course, the 19th Amendment, how women won the vote, is on exhibit now at the National Constitution Center. National Constitution Center, located
right across from Independence Hall
at 6th and Arch. And of course, for more information about everything we've talked about, for how to visit both the Reconstruction exhibit and the 19th Amendment, how women won the vote, plus all of the permanent exhibits that are on display at the National Constitution Center, go to constitutioncenter.org. And I have to say thanks now to Elena Popchak. She is the exhibition developer for the 19th Amendment, How Women Won the Vote, and of course the Great Civil War and Reconstruction one as well, at the National Constitution Center. Elena, thank you for doing this today.
Thanks so much, Laura. I'm excited to share this exhibit with our visitors.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.